Okay, thanks very much, Adrian. Well, first, I just want to take this chance to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very intensive session. It's been very thought-provoking, and I think it's been very useful for highlighting some issues that I think, from ideas coming from different quarters, and at least for me, I think I'm going to go back with some new ideas on perhaps some experiments to do or modeling. What I wanted to tell you about today fits into kind of the series of virus talks we've had, and I guess we've had a number of theoretical talks, and so I've cut out a lot of the introduction, but I'll leave a few things in just that are relevant to kind of the discussion here. And I guess the other thing I'll do is I'll just maybe open by saying that I'll tell it a little bit from my perspective. I actually started thinking about viruses when I was a postdoc here, and that's coming on 10 years now. And I guess in some ways I think it's, if you look at the efforts that are being made in trying to make progress in understanding this, I think it's very tempting to try to apply different maybe theoretical ideas from different arenas. But when you try to come and meet with experiments, it's difficult because the experimental data is kind of often it's kind of confounded together, and it's hard to maybe extract information that's really
confounded or compounded.
Maybe I should say compounded. I think that's maybe confounded also. I think the difficulty is just like it's kind of the characteristic problem you have with kinetics, in that the type of information you have is still already several layers abstracted from maybe your underlying physical mechanism you might have in mind. So ideally, you know, in normal kinetic studies, you know, the proof of the pudding is if you can identify some intermediate, and that's of course what we set out to do originally. And and I'll say that actually we weren't really that successful. But we were still able to kind of get kind of the typical type of kinetic information, and that at least provides a starting point for maybe trying to weed through some of the theoretical ideas. Okay, so just to kind of give you, just orient you in the talk, I'll start off and just tell you a little bit about kind of the issues as we saw it, or as I saw it at the time when we started thinking about virus assembly. And then kind of I'll talk about how we ended up starting to do these type of set of experiments. So this is wading into the swamp here. And then according to MapQuest, that's basically we tried to fit to some theoretical models, and really those are the ones we'll be comparing to are due to Adam Zlotnick here. And I'll just mention it's actually great to be here while Adam's here, because since Adam really pioneered a lot of these sort of kinetic view of looking at understanding both from doing modeling and also doing experiments, trying to understand virus assembly. This kind of fits very much in that framework, but I think there's some open questions still. And I'd like to finish on some, I'll just mention this experimental work, I'll basically focus on stuff that we published in Virology, I guess almost 2 years back now, but I'll also have some unpublished results which differ and maybe extend some of the results we had. Okay, so in terms of the origins, okay, so just to kind of give you a quick one-slide snapshot of what it's all about, here's electron micrographs of the actual assembly process of polyoma. We actually did two viruses, polyoma and papilloma, and you can see that basically early in time here, you can see a field of the assembling unit here, which is actually a pentamer, and So the protein is just one of these colors, and five of them together, they assemble early on into a pentamer, and basically you always see this pentamer, even as soon as it's expressed. So it's kind of confusing because this is kind of like the monomer, if you're thinking about this is a polymerization reaction here. So just kind of avoid that terminology. I might call that the capsomere, or people affectionately call this the donut sometimes.
Five proteins? Yes, five.
There's one here because, okay, this is just to illustrate the inter-donut bonding.
What's the time scale? What time do you...
Okay, so when we did it in polyoma, so we started off doing experiments in polyoma, and basically you see we see at least three characteristic time scales, but the whole thing took us days to complete.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and so we kind of slogged around with that for a little while, and then we ended up doing papilloma, and that the whole thing is done in about four or five hours.
This is early. How many minutes in are you saying?
This would be like this would be. We couldn't actually do this. If we started the assembly reaction, we actually couldn't get this fast enough. So this is basically before assembly starts. If you do this in papilloma, you can actually get a field like this. I'll show you pictures of that too.
If you start off with denatured protein.
Yeah.
And
denatured protein?
Well, as genuine monomeric polypeptide. Mm-hmm. How long does it take to form that capsid?
To form this? I don't know that that's ever been measured, because as far as I know, this is always seen immediately.
I don't know if you could take that apart and have it refold.
Yes, I wasn't sure if you really meant completely denatured. I mean, this thing, we also, in addition to calling it a donut, we affectionately also call it these rocks, because it seems like, I mean, you can put this in quite stringent conditions.
So where are they coming from? Where do you start?
So basically, these are expressed, I mean, the ones that we have are expressed in E. coli as fusion proteins, and then they're clipped. And as soon as they're actually, even as fusion proteins, they're already in the pentameric form.
So they're folded in E. coli.
Yeah, yeah.
And to form the capsids from these pentameric units, what do? You change the pH, the salt, or?
I'll show you that in a minute. We'll change both the pH and the salt. And actually, one of the important things, when you do, so in polyoma, we change both the salt, pH salt, and also we add calcium. For papilloma, we change pH salt, and we also dilute out a reducing agent.
So this is a huge parameter space. I mean, there were recipes before, or?
There were recipes before, right. So I should say that basically this work is done, also we're collaborating with Bob Garcia, who's done really kind of a lot of the early legwork in mapping out the biochemical space of the assembly and misassemblies in polyoma and papilloma. Yeah. So this is kind of the general picture here. And I guess there's a lot of evidence before, just looking at EMs, to see that, kind of give you the flavor that, well, you got various pieces here, and you might try to imagine from this that there's kind of a distribution of intermediates, and the intermediates eventually come along and form these capsids. Now, these capsids, one of the things that's difficult in just negative stain EM is that you're never really sure completely if there are different artifacts here of when these actually get stained. You don't know whether they're squished or, I mean, the other thing is also in vitro, they're not as faithfully, regularly assembled as they are in vivo, where there's other factors. I should mention that also, I'll talk about that a little bit more. This slide is just to kind of give you a summary. So kind of the basic question is, these donuts somehow need to get to this very regular structure, and we've had a number of talks explain that this is actually this is a precise structure, not kind of a random assortment here. And what we try to do is we look at, we track the molecular weight, average molecular weight of this population with time using multi-angle laser light scattering. Okay, and basically we can see different phases in this growth.
And the scale of time?
Okay, this is actually for papilloma here. This might be 10 minutes here, and this might be a couple of hours, two to four hours here, depending on the concentration. Yeah.
Can you look at distribution?
The population distribution?
Yeah, at the given moment of time, just snap up the distribution.
We can't from light scattering, from the static light scattering. We actually did try dynamic light scattering. We didn't get enough resolution to really say anything conclusive.
And fractionation helped those lights.
I think fractionation, that is, we tried, I'll mention we did try field flow fractionation. The thing is, in fractionation, I think it could work if the conditions are right, but there's always, you're kind of never really sure also if during the fractionation you're basically changing the conditions, you're diluting, you're locally diluting, so you're actually, depending on the time scale of the measurement.
Right, it's slow compared to the scale, but it's
right.
Fast compared to scale.
Right, so like a typical FFF experiment would also be on the order of 10 minutes, half an hour. So we tried, there's one other thing that we actually tried later, which is we actually tried to quench I mean, one of the things that we hoped would work is that we would start the assembly, and if we could find some chemical way to quench it, then we could do perhaps fractionation. And that's another reason why actually we switched to papilloma, because actually in papilloma we'll see, well, I'll talk about it in a minute, papilloma, the pentamers actually form interpentameric disulfide bonds. And it's not clear at when exactly that happens, but we do know that if you leave the reducing agent in, you actually don't form capsids. So,
if you're referring from what is the fraction of which initial material that went into the finished caps?
Okay, so one of the things is, in principle, in retrospect, we should have really done a systematic study of that, and that's one thing we didn't. We tended to basically work at fairly concentrated conditions, and since we could track the average, the total molecular weight, we could see that we're most of the time, it's mostly going to capsid for the concentrations that we're
getting.
Yeah.
So which of this part of the plot corresponds to those figures? Can you
sort of? Yeah. So this would be here. This is probably in here somewhere. And that's toward, this is basically towards
the
end here.
I think you're only showing this to give us an introduction.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned that, so I was here doing a postdoc, and actually at the time I was working at block copolymer thermodynamics, and one of the problems we happened to be working on at the time was how to maybe make a synthetic block copolymer in such a way that you form a closed shell. And that turns out, actually, when you look through the parameter space to be not that, it tends to be a fairly small portion of parameter space. In fact, we couldn't even find it with three blocks. We had to do it with four blocks to get everything right so it's competitive against lamellar phases and micelles and everything. And I think that kind of the general picture is like how much information is really in this assembling piece that you can form a specific structure. Now, even this is just forming something that's round. And of course, that's forming something which has a lot more. The parameter space is larger. Well, so this was in solution. We were looking, and presumably it'd be spherical. We were looking for spherical solutions. Okay. So as I said, so kind of our framework, this I'm just introducing kind of the framework here. There are questions about the part, you know, how much information, what interactions go into the part that tell it what structure forms eventually. And the thing with viruses, I'll talk a little bit about what's known. This is where the crystallographic information is very powerful. It tells you a lot, but in some ways it tells you that there's actually a lot of, you know, there's specific salt-mediated interactions, hydrophobic, and also disulfide interactions. So this is actually perhaps hard to encode in a simple theory. In some ways, we end up focusing more on this part, the process, which is looking at mechanisms, cooperativity, issues of thermodynamics, and fluctuations. And I'll say that in part, at that time, there was actually two, I think, very influential papers. One was a local rules paper, which I think was talked about earlier, which had kind of this programmatic way of building a structure. And it was striking in that you could get specificity in the structure, the particular lattices you want, but it didn't have the flavor of a typical kind of fluctuating chemical feeling to it. So I think that raised a lot of questions. Adam's early paper in 94 had kind of was maybe at the other end of the spectrum, where he postulated that just through equilibrium interactions you could actually form a closed capsid, and that kind of has a micellar type flavor to it also. So the question is, maybe somewhere in between that you can understand how virus assembly works. And for instance, one of the questions you could ask is, are there identifiable mechanisms or pathways? And I think this is one of, particularly for biologists, this is a key question, because if there is one, that might be a target, for instance. I'd say implicitly, the other thing is that when you look at that picture, the cartoon, you can imagine the multitude of different reactions that can happen at the same time. So the question is, can we simplify that down? And I think that's been kind of a theme also in the theoretical work. For instance, a lot of work is saying that you can just sequentially add or take off single monomer. Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
I sort of
donut.
Was that you couldn't do it, that you would have to go with this very large energy barrier. If you add it sequentially, you have to go for 50 kT.
That's kind of what came out of the discussion,
yes,
when in Paul's talk, but I guess that remains controversial, because I believe, Adam, you probably still
I don't see a need to have.
We had three talks. All of them emphasized this effect that you have to cope with very hard. Raiden Twarok, Paul von der Schoek, also Chris, they all emphasized that this energy barrier that you have to overcome. But maybe we'll talk about it.
Okay. In the viruses that we looked at, polyoma and papilloma, that there are actually specific intermediates that have been postulated, which I'll talk about. So we can maybe try to find that out. And I think I should just mention that this kind of physically motivated picture of fire assembly, that actually, that basic language and idea already was existing even back to Casper, who made the analogy to crystallization, and you use the words nucleation and growth. So, okay. Now, I think from this thermodynamics point of view, the question is also relevant today, is that there have been different postulates of whether the structures are thermodynamic optima, or is it rather under kinetic control? And in the same way, when you're looking at the same question of whether assembly happens by these preferred pathways, or whether it somehow is important to take into account all the different multitudes of reactions, that's I'd say still an open question. And also in terms of the time scale is important, as we talked about, for the very high barrier that might make it non-biological or even non-physical. Okay. I think the other thing is there's other motivations for thinking fluctuations are important. One is that I think conceptually, because the structural, the crystallographic, and the cryo-EM work has been so powerful, more thought has been given to that aspect of it rather than think of these as fluctuating structures. And the question is microscopic reversibility, the fact that it can maybe move, is that relevant? I think there's been now a number of experimental evidence that it is, including functional roles, that you need the capsid to be fluctuating for transport, for instance. But I think also just conceptually an important thing for me is the fact that if you make errors, how do you get out of them? And it seems that especially as you get to larger and larger capsids, it becomes more and more easy to make an error, so you need to be able to take care of that. Okay. That's actually one of the points I'll come to back at the end here. All right, so now here's the quick review. I'll just flash this up so that just orient everybody. The icosahedral capsids, they basically have these 5-3 and 2-fold points of symmetry. And this was elaborated upon by Casper and Klug in the theory of quasi-equivalence, and basically each one of these in sort of a triangular, with the idea of triangulation, where you take one of these facets and basically break it up into where before this triangle was maybe one face, that would be broken up to say into four faces here. And this corresponds also to the taking a hexagonal grid and putting five-fold vertices in them and folding them up also. Okay, that's already been talked about, so I won't belabor that. But here, this comes back to the point of errors and correction. The thing is, once you have quasi-equivalence compared to regular icosahedral symmetry, the point is now you have multiple positions that the proteins need to find themselves in correctly. Okay, so and they have to be related to each other in the right positions around the sphere. So this really brings up, this is why I think the question of errors and correction is important. And I think this question really needs to be tied into the question of whether something's off pathway or not, because I think those are qualitatively, I'll discuss more on why that's qualitatively different. And just one more thing, this was also, Raiden talked about this. Yes?
Just regarding this issue, what's the difference in energy if you make a mistake, if the five defects are not positioned?
Just in this conference, I've heard different ideas about that. I mean, I don't know, and I don't know that there's been any experimental that measure of that. If you go look at, say, a molecular mechanics point of view, you can see that the energies are actually fairly high, but those numbers seem to be apparent. The numbers I'm thinking of are like in Jack Johnson's database there on the Viper.
Those are
really high. I mean, if you look at them, they don't seem to really make sense.
Any time where you're talking about KDs in the minus 40th molar range, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
My experimental measurements for protein-protein interactions are always on the ballpark of, say, between 5 and 8 kT for pairwise interactions.
Per contact.
And if you may not see much difference in the immediate interaction, but the subsequent interactions might not be possible if you have defects.
You're talking about this, though, right? You're talking about this.
But the question is whether they should.
No.
What Adam is saying is,
if you put a piece in wrong, you won't. You that piece may fit in, may bind just as well as a piece that's right, but the subsequent pieces won't be able to add on.
I think you don't understand me. You have in this structure, you always have to have defects just because you have to have the closure.
Defect with respect to what? Do you mean?
Well, defect with respect to the planar geometry.
You mean pentamers?
The pentamers.
Yeah.
The pentamers.
The fivefolds compared to the sixfold.
What if you don't have 12 pentamers?
Yeah.
What if you don't have 12 pentamers? Yes, I agree. The question is, where do you put these 12 pentamers? And usually, you put them symmetrically as far as possible, one from the other. And my question is, what happens if you bring them closer?
Well, if you take you can take, for instance, a spherical cylinder and compare it with the icosahedral structures. The estimates depend on what you assign to bending or stiffness constants.
Yes.
And typically, when you do continuum theories, you find 10 times the bending modulus. But then the estimates to know what is the estimate for your bending modulus.
But I think...
People try to actually look at the...
Maybe Adam should answer that.
I mean, the question you're asking seems to be, if you have a capsid and you put the defects, the fivefold in non-icosahedral positions. But as the capsid's growing, it doesn't know where those fivefolds are going to be. The proteins can only know the local environment. So that was the response I had previously. Are there examples of non-icosahedral capsids, and certainly the cones,
The protein would not know, but at the end they would may rearrange because they would minimize the energy.
This might be a huge kinetic area to that.
They can move. These crenations can move on a solid surface. These are solids.
But buckyballs have similar constraints. And buckyballs do form with non-icosahedral configurations.
They have seven folds, I think, is how they can manage that.
Well, how many of those are they? I mean, it's easy to answer the question because it's easy to count how many so-called defected or not idealized buckyballs versus or viruses versus.
How can anyone? No one has ever made observations in which they look at slightly defective viruses.
You can find really wildly defective viruses.
No, we're talking about small. If you want to isolate that,
we're not talking about wildly different things. Yeah. He's asking for making just one error. Say, what would
and
be the
looking at the
I
yeah.
Think that people have identified.
I think yeah. I think that's too subtle right now experimentally.
I think a lot of the wildly defective guys, not those nice ones.
We should let David at least get the major stuff.
Yeah. I think the thing I would just mention, though, is that I think there's, even if you try to, I think there's maybe a desire to try to interpret this in terms of defects looking at defects on a, say, a crystal, which I think must be right essentially, but the thing is, and this discussion has come up already, as I mentioned, these are kind of like rocks, and if you look at the way that the structure, internal structure, they actually look like they're quite strongly held together. So you might think that it might be primarily bending, for instance, in which case you would get a different scaling compared to if it's bending dominated compared to like stretching dominated. So I think even just trying to think about it, there's some range of what it might be. Okay. So in terms of coming back to this question of well, one way to get around this, and I think this is partially a motivation for looking at proposing this idea for a mechanism for these T=7 viruses, is that you might have an intermediate that, forms 5 around 1. So if you look at the what you can do is you can look at the form structure here and you can make estimates based on the crystal structure of the strength. If you just look to see the amount of contact between this and this compared to this and this. So, this was predicted to be more favorable energy. So it was postulated that this structure here, five pentamers around one, is an intermediate. And what you can do is if you look, there are 72 of these pentamers. So you have exactly, you can basically take this capsid and break it up into five around one structures. In some ways, that alleviates the problem of having to put things in the right place. Because if you make everybody five around one first, then you can just put them in the icosahedral positions. They still have to fit together properly, but that perhaps is an easier problem. So that's maybe one reason people thought that this 5-around-1 might be an intermediate for this Tegel-7 structure.
You still have an isolated one left over in the three-fold position that has to fit between them, right?
No, 6 times 12, so there's 6. 5-around-1 is 6, and there are 12 of them, so 6 times 12, that's 72. Is that what you mean?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now, coming to our experiments. Now, this is Bob Garcia, who, as I mentioned, has really done a lot of this early work for polyoma and papilloma in terms of mapping out the different assembly structures under different conditions. So we basically, and I'm kind of tempted to do this because this is recorded for all time now, but basically I walked into Bob's office telling him about maybe some of the ideas, some of these more... I guess soft matter ideas, or maybe just physical ideas about analogies between this and fluctuations in forming a crystal. And we were talking about mechanisms and intermediates, and he was asking this question about the 5-round-1, and I said, well, that's something that you should be able to see by light scattering. You can look at with multi-angle light scattering, you can look at the molecular weight and the size. And that's not really a difficult thing. And he said, great, when can you do it? And I actually didn't mean, at that time, I didn't really mean that we would go and do it, but after talking about it, it kind of became apparent between him and me who was going to do it. So that's kind of what got us started off. So you can, now if he ever looks on the web, he'll know. All right, so these are our two viruses, so papilloma and polyoma. They're from the same family, Popova viruses, and which these are the two subfamilies, and SP40s and the polyoma subfamily. They have one interesting thing about this is that they have structural similarity at the tertiary and quaternary level, meaning that they have this comparable T, also the same T structure, but they're not actually, they don't have the same secondary structure. So if you look at the amino acid sequence, there's not a lot of similarity. There's no obvious similarity between them. Here, this kind of gives you just a map of, this is Bob's work here, Bob Garcia's work. And so here, this would be pH 7, and basically by adding calcium or ammonium sulfate, you can form, this would be normal assembly here, forming into normal sized capsids, but you can see that under different conditions you form, this shows the polymorphism of polyoma.
Are those the snub cubes, upper right?
The what?
The 24.
Oh, the octahedral ones? Yeah. I don't remember. I was going to show that on the next slide here. This is, I guess, talking about this one, I guess. Yeah. Okay.
The previous slide, you have arrows back and forth. Does it mean that it is all reversible?
That is what it, that's what it means. Amazing. Yeah, it is amazing. It's kind of crazy.
The absence of arrows means it's not reversible.
So I think the absence of arrow means the experiment wasn't done. I don't know.
Yeah. Are you going to draw this on the phase diagram in the next slide?
No.
So what are the guys at the lower left?
Here?
Yeah.
Well, these are you have it's more size variations here. So for instance, you see these large guys here and the small ones. This is more uniform compared to that one.
Are they all the sizes that you mentioned, 12, 24, and 72, or are they other?
No, these are larger. So the 72 is this one right here.
So David, why are virologists so allergic to measuring phase diagrams for shelf assembly? Kluge did it and then one other one. And why don't they ever do it? What's with him? Why don't they make quantitative
I think
Oscar Scheer why he didn't do it?
Well, interestingly, I mean, I've learned a lot over the years in talking to him because he's really a hardcore virologist. And even when we talked with Adam before about some of the theoretical ideas, he's like, he's the guy that we need to convince when we bring some new ideas. And that's definitely been the case. And the thing is, I think it's probably a matter of what's important to them. I mean, for me, this is, and people in this room, I think the physical aspects of this is really interesting, not just for the biology, but also for the physics and the engineering, the technology eventually. But, Bob basically, in some sense, would and has said that this is kind of a sideshow to to what's really important biologically.
Because biology is only interested in pH 7 and without calcium. Very specific.
Yeah.
Very specific condition, and that's it. And what's going on around is not.
Well, I mean, it is still relevant.
It's innovative work here. I think it's
Let's see to cry out for the next step. Do it really systematically, very pH, very salinity, and make.
I know that you have infinite amounts of time.
You're very generous with your time.
Yeah. So, and I think. To make progress here for the type of idea, for resolving the questions here, we will have to do that. Yeah, Adrian?
Is the sense that these move smoothly from one to the other, or they just totally come apart somehow and refine themselves?
Even though these are double arrows, I think these do actually take quite some time.
Uh-huh. And so it's probably going, falling apart and then coming to... that really says something about the stability of the thing in the first place.
Right.
It's move a little bit
right.
And actually is able to come apart into something else. So what should we be thinking here? Is it, I mean, Robin, of course, is thinking of gas and liquid transitions. What should we be thinking in terms of the rearranging the process that has to go on to follow one of those arrows?
Is anything known about this?
I don't know. I think this, I mean, the types of, when these studies were done, basically they were done by looking at the EMs. So what?
See the final image
right. So these weren't tracked, for instance, kinetically, or yeah.
And it's like my grandmother with the recipes. You wait long enough. So.
Yeah. Which is kind of why I think, if you go back in the history of doing kinetic studies, of course, there's a lot of work done on the rod-like viruses, and there's it's a better defined, easier to analyze system in a sense. Then in terms of actually tracking this, I'm really only aware of. The French group back in the 80s who did some nice work, and then R2 work, is that basically it?
Yeah.
I think that's it.
And you characterize it by just electromicroscopy, or you think to show solo X-ray diffraction?
I'll show you just the negative stain EM and light scattering, that's it.
And don't do X-ray diffraction, just to determine the size of the particles.
X-ray diffraction, you mean?
Too much work, I think.
Yeah. Are you talking about in the crystal, or are you talking about in solution?
No.
You're talking about solution?
Postdoc in Jack Johnson's lab is doing small angle.
Yeah.
Here it's really been doing small angle for a while.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but that doesn't give you the entire the structure the way you get with X-ray crystal.
No, of course, but
it's
still
the
size of the.
Yeah.
But if it's poly dispersed, if you have multiple sizes, but it gets very smeary.
This guy's data is pretty nice. Multi-angle light scattering gives you.
I'm asking the question because in membranes, people looking at vesicles, colloids, or whatever, this is the standard technique that they're using to
people really
characterize
my cells. If you have my cells of different size, could they determine the size distribution with small angle X-ray? I don't know.
No, I doubt it.
If you have one size, you can do it. If you have one nice sphere,
I think sometimes if you have a suspicion for like a two populations, which I think maybe in some of Jack's work, there's other reasons to think you might have like a bimodal distribution.
In Jack's work, he knows there's a sequence of structures.
Right.
But when you have a distribution of sizes and you don't know what the relative amounts is, it's extraordinarily difficult to
place. Yeah. Even if you go back to the Quillel, the French group, they tried to fit it that way, for instance. So they did small angle X-ray, and they made a hypothetical four sizes that they tried to fit. And even there, they couldn't quite get it all to work. Like, they couldn't actually have a component which was like the full capsid. So, they have kind of a nice curve showing general progression going through the different intermediates, but it didn't completely hold together there, even. Okay. All right, so... But I just said this was kind of a biological sideshow, but I think in some ways this is going to be perhaps have new relevance, actual importance to the outside world. And that's because of, particularly for papillomavirus, first of all, let me just give you a quick introduction. There are actually about 90 known, more than 90 known strains of HPV. The genome is closed, circular, 8 kilobase, double-stranded DNA that's associated with host histones into a mini chromosome. There are two structural proteins, L1 and L2, And primarily, this L1 is a major capsid protein, and L2 is actually, I think it's only there in small amount, and it's not resolved in X-ray. In fact, it's just believed to be maybe even inside the capsid. The assembly occurs, I should just mention, the nucleus of a cell, not in the reducing cytoplasm. So that's kind of one hypothesis for the involvement of these disulfide bonds biologically. And the other thing I should say that in vivo, host chaperones also are known to mediate the assembly and disassembly.
Is there any in vitro self-assembly with the double stranded DNA?
That is coming, I think, but I don't think that's been done yet.
Okay.
Yeah, that's coming.
What is there on this AKB? That's a very small, it's almost a plasmid. What formation is there on that AKB DNA?
What formation? I'm not sure I understand.
Formation?
I think it's
just a few proteins, typically.
How much is on there? Yes, I think there are a couple of structural proteins, and maybe, I don't know if there's a T antigen on as well.
It's about four proteins.
Yeah.
And it's actually packaged as a mini chromosome with a bunch of histones, so it takes up a fair bit of space internally.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the, just 8 kb means it must not have its DNA polymerase, you know. It's a
host. No, uses the host. The cell does that.
I'm not an expert in viruses. I'm just surprised that the virus with 8 kb can actually be infectious because 8 kb
yeah, they're smaller.
Yeah. 3 or 4 kb.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
The virus is with 3 kb.
Yeah. I think like polyoma is actually about 5 kb. And that only polyoma. Even polyoma, it codes for like four. I think there are four, but two of them are kind of like the same because it's just like you use the same sequence and you cut a little piece off. But but the point is, the reason why this is important is because HPV has been linked to cervical cancer. I think this is worth taking just a moment talking about this. Cervical cancer kills about 300,000 women each year worldwide, mostly in developing countries, because here we have Pap smears and we can treat for that. And the thing is, impressively, nearly all cervical cancers show HPV infections, and therefore, the idea is that if you can target HPV, you could actually maybe target cervical cancer. Just to kind of give you the magnitude of this infection, 75% of all sexually active women have been infected. Currently, there are probably about 20 million people in the world who are actually infected. And in the U.S., there's probably 6 million new HPV infections per year.
There are only 13 million sexually active women.
Yeah,
what?
That's a euphemism.
Huh? No. This is infected. This is have been infected. It's not that desperate. This is in their life. 75% within their life. This is currently. Yes. This is a fascinating point, I see.
With only four proteins, how does it... It's a sidetrack, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
It involves itself to cancer. Which
of these four proteins are not that carcinogenic, right? Just a couple?
Well, I guess there are two. There's one that's associated with about 50% of them. There's another one for about another quarter.
Does it insert itself in the host DNA?
Well, I don't know if that's been... originally, the association was done epidemiologically. So what they can see is that after the infection, there are basically little lesions that form, and then eventually that's associated with the appearance of cancer later. So I don't know if that whole... I don't know if physiologically, in terms of the body...
So how it causes cancer is not known? Or is it...
I certainly don't know. I don't know if...
I don't think it's particularly clear to anyone.
Yeah. Okay, but here's kind of one of the big news, and this was actually just a couple of weeks ago. So the thing is, the pictures that we're showing, these HPV virus-like particles, and I say they're virus-like particles because they don't have the minor protein, they don't have the genome, it's just that one protein. These capsids are being used as vaccines, and that was, so I think it's been about 20 years since, I guess, a French group did the epidemiological studies associated with HPV. It took about 10 years to kind of start gearing up with the early idea of using these as a vaccine, but just 2 weeks ago, this was approved by the FDA. So this will be actually the second cancer vaccine to be deployed, the first being hepatitis B, which was, I know this because since my family's in Taiwan, it had an enormous impact. Like in one generation, it went from 85% infection to basically nothing. When they did clinical trials of this, basically it was a 100% effective in phase 3 on 12,000 women in 13 countries. I mean, it just seems to be completely effective. It targets actually several strains of HPV, which they expect to be about 70% of cervical cancer cases and 90% of genital warts. So they're thinking about trying to sell this to men as well. I guess they, for the course for the vaccine, it's going to cost about $360 per person, or about $2 billion in sales. And the idea is that it's to be administered pre-puberty, because it can take about 2 decades from infection to cancer, which is why I think people don't know exactly how the cancer arises. And one interesting thing is, in the news, there's actually been some opposition from conservative groups as saying this might be kind of encouraging, deflecting the message from abstinence, say. And then, the Gates Foundation, which has been in the news also recently, has already given a $30 million grant to look how to study and distribute this in poor countries.
What was the other virus you said is also approved for use as a
vaccine? Hepatitis B. Yeah. Okay.
And this, because it triggers the immune system, just the outer shell of the virus stimulates the antibody response.
Right. And so basically during the 10-year period, immunological studies were done to see where it binds. And interestingly,
when
Bob,
the vaccine works, that you fabricate the capsid protein in E. coli or whatever you.
They actually do it in insect cells, I think. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And actually, Bob had this other kind of really neat idea, which was, so I mentioned that our proteins are made as fusion proteins. So he had the idea that, and they come out as pentamers. So he actually was able to establish that those themselves can trigger an immunological response, just the pentamers themselves. So that hopefully, that will be a cheaper way to go. Okay. So now for people like us who are interested in assembly, just to orient you to the kind of what this donut looks like. So, here's just a comparison. Here's polyoma and here's papilloma. As I mentioned, they have similar coronary structures. So they both form these donuts. This one's a little bit more conical. I should just mention this X-ray structure was more recent. This was done in not the native T equals 7 capsid, but they were actually able to form T equals 1 capsids under different buffer conditions and crystallize this. And so just to give you a more physical idea of how the binding happens. In papilloma, basically what you have is near the C-terminus, you have several helicals, you have several alpha helices here which form this helical subdomain. And by looking at the structure, it is inferred that these are needed for interpentamer contacts. Okay, so basically you have these little helices that stick out. And I'll show you a picture of how they interdigitate with the other ones. Polyoma, by contrast, has also in the C-terminus, has an arm which is not regular when you do X-ray, but when it forms a capsid, you can see that these regularize and form an interaction between one pentamer and the next. The N-terminus of this controls the size just by doing so. These were basically, a lot of these were done by doing deletion studies. You cut pieces off and you see what forms. And if you cut there's one base on the N-terminus size that if you cut beyond that, it goes from T equals 7 to T equals 1. And that's kind of this, yeah.
Is the N, what is what holds together within the pentamer?
Within the pentamer?
C-terminus, right?
No. Well, in here it's the N-terminus. Here, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. There are actually involvements. There are actually helices that do penetrate into. There are other helices here that penetrate. I think these H5. Basically, the shape of these, they fit together quite well, so that they're held together that way.
But that's what you said. It's the C-terminus, which is needed.
He said the interpentamer.
Interpentamer, yeah.
Right.
So between one donut and the next donut.
Right.
These guys are for. I'll show you another picture. You'll see that in the next picture.
Just saying, yes. Slowly though, about the T's and the 7 and the 1.
Yeah. So what happens is, you did a bunch of deletion studies where you cut off the N-terminus, and you can kind of march along, and if you cut, it's making T equals 7, you cut one more, and it makes T equals 1. Okay. If you look to see where that is, it's one of these helices. It's part that actually is nearby these... the helical subdomain. So one hypothesis would be, is it affects coming back to this bending idea, that if it can kind of fit in there, it can change the how hard it is to form a bent structure compared to a flat structure. The C-terminus, okay, and I know that several of you...
As though the angle is controlling the entire closure somehow. I mean, usually you don't think of this having a huge amount of energy,
yeah.
Torquing and all this kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's a mystery why one amino acid would do that. I mean, of course, it's hard to say because, I mean, so the sizes were done not, they weren't crystal structures for all of these. These were just basically looking at EMs and looking at the sizes that appeared.
CCMP, there's also one amino acid, the glutamine, which if you mutate it, you change the size
right.
of the scallop by 10%.
Yeah. Right.
Chase and lambda 2, where a single amino acid change makes the particle go from T+7 to T+4.
Right, right. So I think that, I don't know, maybe in those cases whether the structure of the two different cases have been resolved. I mean, I think one of the things to see whether it's cooperative, whether there's, you have to look in detail at how that, whether it changes like gross conformation.
But the sensitivity to yeah. single amino acid mutations makes continuum theories a little bit questionable.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Seem to rely on,
yes.
like to rely on multiple more
yes.
equivalent contents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think...
All the T's you go from 7 straight to 1.
Yeah.
Which is also amazing.
Well, it sort of suggests that the early stages in the assembly might, if you have a given starting curvature, you're going to wind up with a given size particle rather than having things rearranged post-assembly.
Actually, if you look at the rules that were Ryman and Farr talked about last week, and I've made a slight modification of them, the rules do not allow the T=3 or T=4 cases. So it's either T=1 or T=7.
For papilloma, you mean?
Yeah, the rule
for those tiles, you're saying.
The rule that the tiling with the modification of that allows you to consider a variety of tilings, but it was not consistent with my possible symmetry if it was T=3 or T=4.
Yeah, if you do the disk backing, you get the same conclusion. You don't get T=3. You can get T=1, then the 24, and then T=7, but you won't get T=4.
Yeah.
I mean, if the disks are equal size, you
want. Yeah. Okay. So just I know there's been a lot of talk about the genome here. So I just want to add this because I know there's interest in this question. So if you look at the C terminus of the papilloma, this is the part that's positively charged and is presumably going to be interacting with the DNA, and this is disordered inside. And that's compared to the polyoma. It's actually the N terminus. Is actually positively charged and actually interacting with the DNA. The other kind of structural thing I want to, since I'll show you a little bit of data on polyoma, the other thing I want to just mention is that the disulfide, as I mentioned, this is sensitive to reducing agent. The disulfide, there are disulfide bonds in both. In polyoma, the disulfide bonds are inside one pentamer, whereas in papilloma, there's an important one here that's conserved between all the different strains, which presumably is involved in binding the pentamers together. Okay, so here's a picture of basically, this is a T=1, this is not the normal capsid, but the smaller one, and you can see basically, here's the helical subdomains interacting, and they form this kind of trivalent bond here. And if you look at the amino acid sequence here, it's basically, you can expect that this is a strong hydrophobic type interaction, plus there's this conserved, as I mentioned, this conserved cysteine, which is involved in disulfide bond formation. Okay. All right. So, just to orient you now in terms of the pictures I'm going to show you. So, the molecular weight of this single protein is 55 kilodaltons. So, the capsomeres, or these donuts, are L1 pentamers. They're 275 kilodaltons. 60 of those are hexavalent, 12 are pentavalent in this T=7 structure to give you a capsid which is 20 million molecular weight. Okay. And so, the diameter is just about. Actually, that should be about 60. Okay, so here's, as I mentioned, you can see the field of unassociated pentamers 10 minutes into assembly for papilloma because it's slow enough. The contrast isn't that great, but you can kind of see that these are basically the donut structures. And here's, in 40 minutes in, you get something that looks like this. And you do see things like this where it's kind of like a partially formed shell with maybe a hole in it, but again, because it's EM, you're not.
If I could back you up one second.
Yeah.
So you do have some aggregates floating around in there. Is that typical? Do you see those sorts of aggregates? Is that a staining artifact?
We don't. That's the thing. Like? We don't know. We don't know if it's staining. It's hard for us to tell when it's staining and when it's not. And there is maybe some reason to think that there could be aggregation, if from the point of view of the disulfide bonds, but we don't really know.
Another question about this is: are the donuts, are they all oriented in random directions here, or does the process sort of flatten?
This process, I think, tends. I mean, our feeling has been that. And it's not as maybe clear here as in other slides, but you tend to see the barrel of the donut. So apparently there's some. Appears to be there's some interaction with the surface that's making it sit.
I've seen the value when you're looking down the five-fold axis.
Or yeah, right. Yeah, I mean there are other pictures where it's much more apparent. Okay, and so this is 40 minutes into assembly, and as I mentioned, you see these kind of controlling for the fact that you don't know whether the staining is interfering with it or not. You see kind of these partially formed intermediates.
Well,
and also maybe these clumping.
Yeah. Similar preparation, but you haven't dried them down to look at it like this.
Right.
Is that rough scattering, although I won't tell you the structure, is it consistent with this kind of a distribution? Because very often, light scattering is dominated by a certain minority, and those could be the minority that you'd be seeing.
Yeah, I think we didn't do quantitative studies of trying to count, for instance, because also we don't know whether the stain is, as we mentioned, we don't know if that's causing
that. Exactly. I mean, it'd be the thing that you'd want to look at it from a...
We haven't looked at that quantitatively. Yeah. I mean, what we do, basically what we do is when we do the light scattering studies, we'll take out a little bit and do the...
You did this character here, you took a drop at him, and you looked to see which you probably could see with this fraction of big guys, you'd see him in light scattering.
We haven't seen anything that looks really off. I mean, I suppose we probably could look at this and say roughly there are this number of big guys and maybe do a little better estimate. We didn't do that. We just looked at it roughly, and it seems to be consistent.
Are they too small
for that? No. So originally we were hoping to press it down to get the radius information. So they're for us, they're too small to really get size information. Yes, right. So the scattering is basically, it's the weight average molecular weight. So it's proportional concentration and the weight average molecular weight. So we do see they are dominated by the largest guys. Yeah. Okay, so this is 100 minutes in. And again, you can see here we have these kind of better formed capsids. Okay. So,
Mm-hmm. In that previous slide, you also had lots of tenomers floating around in the background as well.
Right.
At this point, assembly is still ongoing, based on your experience?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the endpoint efficiency?
The way we tell that is by looking at the absence. Since we're doing mols, we can look at the absolute molecular weight. And it's always close to what we expect, which is close to 20 megadaltons. So I think it's close. I mean, again, it's hard to tell because it's, but it's close to, I'd say in terms of trying to put error bars on that number, there are two things. One is that when you do the light scattering experiments, it's actually, there's a fair amount of noise. So, and we're very sensitive to things like dust, and so we have to be very, very careful in our filtration to make sure everything's fine. And then we can basically extrapolate. And when we do, we probably can only get to within 10-20%. Okay, so that's kind of one error bar just from doing that. Then on top of that, I think there's a question of how much of the small guys could you have, and so we can put a limit on that roughly. But these are basically 72 times more massive than this, so these are contributing per monomer 72 times more. So that actually, I guess that actually leaves a fair amount of room for how much pentamer you could have.
Just a stupid question from the theorist. The reason it's dark in the center is that because when you do the scattering and you look at the edges you get and you look vertically up, then the vertical part of the capsid does a lot more scattering than if you go along the north to the south pole.
You're talking about here?
And this is kind of caps it. Shell. So you see the center is the scattering. If you go from the north to the south pole, if it's lying on the surface, it's relatively weak compared to having this electron microscopy, right?
Right.
Along the perimeter where the walls of the capsid are more or less vertical.
That's good. I don't know why it's a stain.
It's a stain.
Right, but I'm trying to,
So negative stain. So why don't I see uniformly lighted sphere? Why do I see
that? Yeah, that's what I'm just trying to, I don't know why the stain is
in the middle. Stain passes on the outside and goes on the inside. It doesn't stain the protein.
So it's not staining the protein. Part of what you're saying is absolutely right. You're sort of looking down the cylinder with a little bit of protein top and bottom. Also, stain is penetrating and accumulating on the interior, which is why they have a nice dark inside.
And that's why they always look like this, because of the geometry. That's why they look like donuts.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This is a urinal acid.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is a non-boring salt. It's got it could be doing something itself.
Yeah. Okay. Good adjective. Okay. So just one slide, or just a very quick review. So the thing is, we basically collect at different angles here, and in principle, by looking at the, I'm sure you all know this, but by looking at the angle variation, in principle, you can find RG. If you go to the Wyatt website, they say you can get down to about 20. Nanometers, but we could really only push it down to about 50 or so. We can see the size of our particles, but when they're capsids, but we can't really resolve anything lower. And basically, we did this at various concentrations, and we're going to look at the kinetics of this by looking at the relative rates of assembly, different concentrations, the initial growth rate, and the lag time. So basically, the procedure is we start off with the protein stored at higher pH, lower salt. It's stored in minus 70. But what happens is we just take that. We introduce this into a triply filtered buffer at pH 5.2 and half molar sodium chloride, and assembly begins. And I left off the most important point here, which is that there's actually reducing agent in here, which gets diluted out. Okay, so assembly begins. And then basically, we track the average light scattering. Afterwards, we measure the concentration by UV absorption. Okay, and basically by measuring at different concentrations, at different angles, we can extrapolate to get the molecular weight. Okay, so this is kind of the curve that we get, and basically down here, for some time we get this flat phase, this lag phase, and when we look at this, I'll show a zoom in on this in a minute, but this basically corresponds to the 55 kilodalton in that range that we're expecting. So this looks just like plain capsomere, and that's consistent with the EMs. At some point, we see this kind of sharp takeoff, and that's one thing that we'll kind of talk about, is that this part is actually, if you compare this to the experiments that Adam has done, or even if you look at some of the models or the Quilel group, this part is kind of different from the other scattering data, the fact that this is so flat and then suddenly takes off like that. Then it takes off at a given rate and then eventually plateaus out. Here, we're expecting about 20 megadaltons, so here's a little bit higher.
Suggestive of a nucleation step, that you have to wait and then suddenly
right.
goes over a barrier.
So it could be a nucleation thing. One of the things is that I think one issue for us is whether if you try to understand this in terms of nucleation, this would be the transient, not the steady state nucleation part. The steady state nucleation would be a Poisson process, and so that would be averaged, right? So you just see right exactly parallel on T. So the transient, the question is then it becomes a question of how quickly does the population move into steady state. And this is kind of one of the questions we had. We played around with some of Adam's models, for instance, which has that transient behavior, and the question is how quickly does that form? How abruptly does that form? And so it's possible perhaps that in transient nucleation you could have something that starts very quickly. It wasn't really obvious to us that it would, rather than kind of easing into it.
What's the fusion time for pentamer to a pentamer?
So we estimated the fusion time. It's about one every I think it's on the nanosecond.
Okay, so nothing to do with this time scale.
Right.
And it, really, in that earliest phase there, in that first 20 minutes,
yeah.
if you were to blow that up,
yeah.
Do you see it's actually a horizontal?
I'll show you that. I'll show you that in a minute. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Paul?
David.
Yeah.
The concentration, is this being true? 79 grams per meter?
That's 79 micrograms per milliliter. Sorry, it's underneath there. Yeah, one of the things is that $360 rate. So we would go to basically. So they're down in Denver. We're in Golden, which is about 25 minutes away. We drive down there, and every time we'd pick up the sample, they'd wince. And now that I see that $350 figure attached to the vaccine, I realize every time we're going down there, each one of those up indoors was several thousand dollars. So, so I should just say, I mean, it actually, we were limited by the amount of protein that we could have. So we actually have a limited number. We couldn't do a lot of repeats. So I think you know, each experiment had to count. Michael?
Where is the, on this graph would be your six rings together that you said it was?
Oh, the five around one? So that would, yeah, so that would be here.
So there isn't much.
So we don't see, that's right. So that was one of the first conclusions is if we had a long-lived intermediate, you might see some characteristic size there, which we don't see that.
Well, if you have a mixture of that and a unimer, you would see something lower.
Right.
Which you don't.
Right. Right. So, I mean,
that's
to us.
Mass hypothesis.
Yeah. Right. Because it solves the structural issue, but we don't see an. I think.
And what was the problem with dynamic scattering? You mentioned if you couldn't do it.
Yeah, I think it's possible, but we had trouble. We just couldn't get it to work in our system for some reason. The numbers weren't coming out right somehow. We couldn't quite figure it out.
And the quantum wouldn't give you that
spectrum? Yeah, I'm trying to remember now. It's been a long time, but we had some. I don't quite remember.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, dynamic light scattering is hopeless if you have more than like three components. So.
In terms of resolving the components,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I think we were hoping to get kind of a.
Get into all kinds of stuff.
We were hoping to get maybe just a width. I mean, we wouldn't be able to get a lot of information, right. But yeah. Okay. So what we're basically going to do is analyze this, the length of this lag time and its concentration dependence, the rate of this initial growth, and then, well, we won't be analyzing that, but that's basically, it tops out, that's the plateau. Okay. So we basically collect the our information for different concentrations here. So we range from about 20 micrograms per milliliter to about 200 micrograms per milliliter. Okay. And basically, I should just mention that although we do measure the absolute molecular weight, as I mentioned, that because you have to extrapolate, there's more noise in that than, say, focusing on one. We can focus on one angle, and once you establish the proportionality, the scattering at that angle is also proportional to the weight average molecular weight. Okay, so we'll focus on these two features of this curve: the initial growth, what is that? What occurs during that period? And what does the growth relate to? And the lag time. And this one we'll really analyze using Adam's model, and I won't go into it too much since that, I guess you'll be talking about that tomorrow.
Not
too much.
Long.
Okay. And then the lag time.
I'm focusing on other areas. So.
Okay. All right, so this is a comparison of our experiment against the sequential growth, Adam's sequential growth model. Okay, so just a quick introduction here. If you're trying to, as I mentioned, when you're trying to model capsid assembly kinetics, one of the issues is you have all these different reactions going on, so tracking them and the intermediates might be difficult. So there have been different approaches. One is you can try to simplify these into writing kinetic rate laws, like our master equation. And either simplify down the path of assembly so they maybe have a dominant or maybe look at multiple path. And I'll just make also the comparison. When you look at classical nucleation theory, you're basically making an assumption about the path as well. Another possibility is to do some sort of molecular simulation that allows different intermediates to form in the course of the simulation. Okay, so this is Adam's model in a nutshell. Out of all the different pathways, and I have another slide explaining how he's kind of justified this by looking beyond that assumption in a minute. If you have single, I want to use the word monomer. If you have single units here, what happens is they basically associate by through bimolecular additions of monomer, and they grow like this until they form the capsid. And so the subunits they might form, you might have a nuclei and the subunits add onto the nuclei to form capsid. So that's actually very parallel to the classical nucleation view. Originally, Adam had a model where all these rate constants were the same, and what quickly he showed was that you find that that actually doesn't robustly give you capsid in a reasonable time, because what happens is every reaction uses monomer, so very quickly you become starved of monomer, so you get kind of, you get kinetically trapped. Oh, okay. So a hypothesis, a modification of that was to say that there's a nucleation step in here where it's basically slow up to the nucleation step. So you have a rate constant. One way to model that is you have a certain rate constant up to the critical nucleus, and then you have a faster rate constant proceeding from there. Okay, and from basically, so this becomes, there are a couple of parameters in this theory. There's a contact energy, there's the two rate constants, and also the nucleation size, which you could try to pull out from this curve.
Is it still thermodynamic?
This is kinetic. So, well, I mean, if you wait long enough, it's thermodynamic, right?
No, I mean, it's still through monomers, all the monomers add up.
Through monomer addition, right.
There's nothing else. Multiples don't oscillate.
No.
Yeah. There's a little dance goes on between Robin and me. He keeps waiting for me to say we should take a break.
Oh, this is...
I'm ending him by not looking at him.
Okay.
But
let's take a break. This is a good place. This is a good place.
This is going to be an issue which people want to hear a lot about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where are you in your...
This is a good place. This is a good place because I'll start showing you interpretation of the data. And also, I'll look at... We did some TOEI calculations to see the effect of the...
act of unanimity. Robin and I agree on 10 minutes.
Okay. Okay, so what I want to talk about the rest of this is basically sort of, one, interpreting the data that we found in terms of models like this, where we think there might be some new things to add, and I'll talk about some steps we've made to look at additions to this model. So just this model, I should just mention, for instance, if you're forming a T equals one particle, then there would be exactly 12 reactions. So let me kind of show here, this is the equilibrium pathway. So there would be exactly 12 intermediates, and basically lumps all the n equals 5, all the pentamers, or all the tetramers, let's say all the tetramers, into one effective species, and counts both for the binding free energy, plus the combinatorial entropy of how many contacts and forward and reverse reactions. And this is just a schematic, this is not that's not the real free energy.
That does not include the entropy associated with possible incorrect binding, the dead end binding.
This takes all the possible. So in the real world, there's real coordinates. So this is already simplified down where there aren't real coordinates. There's only binding, and then out of that, it's simplified down to not counting incorrect angles, say, and from that, it's simplified down to where all the different ways of arranging four on an exact icosahedral scaffold is count. That number is counted. The number of ways you could put four on 12. Okay. So as I mentioned, one way to improve this model in terms of the fact to be is maybe matching phenomenologically is to say that there's a slow part and then a fast part. And I think this free energy is really probably not drawn. It should be drawn more like a nucleation barrier because as we were just discussing with Paul here, in connection to the continuum model, there's a close connection because basically here, if you take a bunch of monomers, say these squares, and you put them together to form sort of a piece, then the energy, the binding, in this model, the energy of this is just the number of new contacts plus the degeneracy factor. And so this is just the volume minus an area, the perimeter. Okay, so this is kind of a discrete version, in a sense, of the classical nucleation theory. Okay, now one thing is one question you might ask is, well, how important is it? How much of an approximation are you making to say that I'm lumping all of these species together? So, as far as I think Adam actually did this one study where he, for t equals one, you can actually enumerate all the different say, intermediates with six species, and basically look to see how all the ones that you can get from, all the ways you can get to a particular one of those. And the general conclusion there was that the original approximation was not that far off. Now, here's kind of where one thing I would just mention, that I think this hypothesis that perhaps that result is resulting from the fact that in the T equals 1 structure, the 12-mer has no quasi-equivalence, so there are no mistakes to be made. Okay, so in a sense, as you're going along, if you put one, you're never making a mistake, so even though it's not exactly right, all you're doing is you're getting the energy and the entropy slightly wrong, but you're kind of still heading down the same funnel. Okay, so so in this model, there are no errors.
What was the magnitude of the energy barrier for n equals whatever, 6? So the midpoint, what was the magnitude?
I think, I don't remember what numbers you...
The range of energies? Or
delta Q?
From the most stable to the least stable, you're talking about... It's not calibrated in terms of KT or anything, but you're comparing 30 interactions versus 6 interactions. For the least stable.
So 24 and your estimate was 5 kt?
Let's say 5 kt.
So it's similar. So,
yeah.
So the energy barrier is then of the order of 100 kt or something like that.
We're not talking a kinetic barrier here. So this is a range of the stability of the intermediates.
Yeah, but I think so one of the discussions, I think there should be a kinetic barrier still,
yeah,
though.
Yes, we tried, I mean, this is a different, this is taken away from David's, maybe I can...
Okay, this, yeah, this is, yeah, I thought this was maybe something you talked about tomorrow. Okay, so basically there's just, for the 12 case, just a bunch of coupled kinetic equations.
One number is more effective than the condition of both groups, right? Adding a monomer is more effective than having several monomers combined.
So in this model, only one monomer adds at a time.
Right, but you can check whether this is the fastest route.
If
you know the concentration, if you know the concentrations of previous ones.
Okay. So for simple cases, what you can see that there's not much gain or loss in having some sort of oligomer form and then co-assemble. In reality...
Based on what?
I made a bunch, rearranged that so for everything formed dimers, and then we had 6 dimers come together. It was...
So you had a 1 plus 1 goes to 2 and then evens from there?
Yeah. And really, the controlling thing in any of these reactions is nucleation rate, if you have a nucleation step. And a propensity to form kinetic traps, if you have kinetic traps. In reality, if you have some capsids that have intermediates and you can see them, you have some viruses where there aren't any peculiar intermediates and you don't see any intermediates at all.
Well, I'm just thinking of whether it's possible to bypass this deep minimum if you, for example, can combine 2 4s, you form an 8, and that will basically, you miss this huge minimum.
In terms of getting over the barrier, right?
Yeah, just jumping over the barrier.
Take a look at the left, at the dashed line in the lower diagram. That's where building a 20-mer. You can see that it's a downhill funnel. There's no minimum in that funnel until you hit the bottom, until you hit the capsid. They will look like that unless you have some peculiarity built in or you have a kinetic trap. So it's really, each intermediate is as stable or more stable than the one smaller than. Good.
Maybe
let's discuss that later. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. Okay. So one thing is that since one of the particular features that we saw in our curve, in our molecular weight plots, was the fact that this lag time was very flat. I'll show you. I'll zoom in on that in a moment. But when we looked at the just running the Adams model here, this both for the case of a single rate constant and also a slow and then a nucleating case, kinetically limit case, where slow and then fast, or sorry, yeah, slow and then fast. We actually saw we didn't see that type of behavior. So in these graphs, we didn't actually see any lag time at all. If you adjust these parameters, you actually get something which is somewhat sigmoidal looking, but still not very flat. It's just kind of this rise that comes up. Okay. So now first let me talk about, before I get to lag time, let me just talk about the initial slope. So the kind of the idea is that once it starts growing, the first part, say, might be the transient nucleation. Then once it starts growing, you basically have, you're in the steady state part of the assembly. And you might be able to, okay, this is kind of a classical argument where you try to analyze the size of the critical nucleus by the apparent order of reaction in terms of the power law dependence on the concentration. So here's kind of one variation, here's one way to kind of justify that. What we say is that, for instance, if you look at the idea is that it's slow here, and once you form a nucleus, this part could be fast. So basically the appearance, the time rate of change of the nucleus, phenomenologically you expect that the appearance of nucleus is basically going to be effective nth order in the subunit concentration. And the reason for that is that, jumping ahead in the argument here. So basically, if this part isn't in pre-equilibrium, if this is slow, basically the ratios of this should be given by the respective constants. So the thing is, the population of this is proportional to the appearance of the concentration of monomer. The population of this is proportional of this times this. So you have two powers of the monomer. And so if you have an n-size nucleus, you expect to be nth order in the subunit. Michael?
Richard, typically when we talk about nucleus, you're moving up and not down on the free energy curve. You go through a maximum and the nucleus and then come down.
Yes.
That's the classical nucleation theory.
Right, right.
And in that case, you would have a period where you have to wait. You seem to be keep going down. All you're changing is the height of the period, which is not nucleation theory.
Right. So this comes back to the same point. And actually, to tell you, so I kind of just sketched this. I didn't put in.
But typically,
right.
If you go from 1 to 2 to 3,
right,
you
normally,
up, not down.
Right. But
yes.
Right. So when I look, okay, so I'll tell you, I haven't thought this through. And so when I saw this, I kind of assumed that this is the discrete version of the classical nucleation theory. But now I'm a little puzzled because if I look at the energies here, all the energies are indeed favorable binding energies,
which is
different. So. Yeah.
I mean, this picture doesn't include a chemical potential as part of that delta G, does it?
That's not true.
No, it's in there. It's in there, just like, yeah, it's in there. Okay.
It doesn't put in the line tensions like it had a very good surfactant.
Yeah, right. So there's this line, it's basically a line tension of zero. That's basically the...
That's right.
Yeah, that's actually right. That's exactly it.
About this proportionality to C naught to Dn, because that's like saying that your system reaction rate is proportional to the
concentration. That's exactly the chemical potential. That's the natural logarithm of the concentration.
I'm just saying, either you treat it as the chemical potential or you say it's proportional to the concentration, but you're not...
It's the same thing.
Yeah, if you're drawing... But the fact that the rates are the rates that are being written in there, the rates are mostly toward the left from that nucleation place. So that would suggest that if you drew the graph properly and put in the chemical potential, that you would be saying that was a peak there, doesn't it?
Sure.
By that?
So, yeah. So, I mean, I guess maybe one way, I think the fact that line, basically, this is a zero line tension model of the classical nucleation theory. So, or you could say that it's a very, in the limit of very low,
well,
what I'm suggesting
is that the assumption you made is equivalent to saying that there is in fact a peak in the free energy somewhere around at that nucleation place.
So, in a nutshell, I'm going to go into this tomorrow, but you can put a kinetic barrier in those early steps, make
these barriers higher, like is drawn here,
or you can put a thermodynamic barrier in there. The effect is very, very similar.
Yeah, but if you put some physics in it, like line tension, then you would argue that the barrier should be at the half field
okay.
capsid, which would be somewhere in the middle.
So, Michael, I think maybe one of the questions, I think this is a really, we're hitting kind of the point here in connecting classical nucleation theory, so I think it's worth discussing, but I think the question is what is that line tension? This comes back to Paul's point, really, of what is the zero when you're trying to connect to the classical nucleation theory. If we're talking about the monomer here, and these are small clusters, then this subunit picture of saying that we estimate the energy here by the number of bound contacts or unbound contacts, that's probably not an accurate picture, which is argues for the fact that the line tension actually maybe is quite small in reality, in if you're making small clusters.
It's possible that in solution a pentamer has a special conformation so that its line tension is much less than if you just suspended
right.
the bonding energy between
right.
two contacts.
Right, so that's possible too. Right.
That's a question which has to be answered by molecular biologists.
Yeah,
starts from
right.
If you just know the number of free contacts that give you immediately the line tension.
That's how these estimates
right, and that's how you get zero.
100 kT barriers, which seem to be prohibitive.
Right.
But maybe something else is going on. Maybe these dangling ends rearrange themselves in a clever way so that effectively the line tension is zero. We know nothing about it. There has been no measurements of that, as far as I know, of that line tension.
Yeah.
We have a line tension over a barrier.
Of the barrier or the barrier height,
I guess. Yeah.
Except it seems to be a lot less than you would get from a naive estimate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, so we expect basically the nucleus to be in this model, so kind of a low line tension model, that the nucleus would appear as effectively nth order, and since the nucleus very rapidly converts to capsid, the concentration of the time dependent nucleus is basically that of the capsid, and this is basically proportional to since the light scattering is dominated by the capsid, this will show up in the average molecular weight, the first approximation. Weight average molecular weight. So if we want to look at this change in time of the nucleus, we could look then with this assumption, look at the slope of the growth of the molecular weight and correlate that or look at that as a function of the initial subunit concentration. So you can plot, for instance, the log of this versus the log of this and just pull off the slope. And I should just mention that there are better estimators of this that Adam has proposed. But since our growth curves are quite linear, if you actually use the other estimators, you end up with the same expression. So basically what we do is we take this data and we look at this initial slope here. So here's a zoomed in part of this. This is actually just the light scattering here. I have other pictures of the molecular weight. We take the slopes and then we plot them so versus the log of the concentration and basically extract the effective exponent there, which is apparently quite close to 2. So this, in this model, this is kind of consistent with the idea that it's effective second order, or the critical nucleus is 2. Okay, so now coming to the lag time, this comes...
Are you going to say anything about relating that to structure?
I'm not sure what you have in mind.
Well, okay. Structurally, there's one particular pentamer-pentamer interaction that's really unique, and it looks like it buries a lot more surface area than any of the other pentamer-pentamer interactions. So the idea of a dimeric nucleus is actually kind of it's nicely consistent with structure.
Is that so? That's taken from the T equals 1 crystal structure?
No, it's taken from looking at the SV40, from poly, looking at
the... Oh, right, right. Well, the thing is that the... I mean, the thing is it's known that the interpentamer contacts are different. I mean, the domains are different between even polyoma and papilloma. So, the thing is, one of the things is that there's kind of this... there's a lot of similarities. So I think that argument could carry some weight, but given the fact that the actual... I mean, when you look... Even the papilloma structure is T equals 1, so, you know.
Yeah, there's a T equals 1 papilloma structure, a T equals 7 polyoma structure.
Right.
By crystallography,
right.
By cryo-EM image reconstruction, there's
right.
numerous of both. And you can...
Of polyoma.
Of papilloma and polyoma. Yeah. So you can actually make pseudoatomic models.
Right.
The rules, the generalizations hold for NS.
The thing is that the if you look at the T=7, the interpentameric contacts are different between, well, both with the T=1, but also with the, between the polyoma and the papilloma, in terms of the, for instance, there's a helical bundle, which is different.
I see, yes. Yeah. The molecular details are different, but the pattern of the pentamers seems to be similar.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so here's, now we're, in terms of coming to this lag time, so this, since this was something which is not seen in other studies, this is something that we try to understand a little better. So one possibility is that the transient nucleation itself is sharp, although we don't have any particular, we don't know if that's really the case or not.
What's the nucleation if you have two monomers, there's no barrier?
So if it's very slow, for some reason the dimer is very slow, dimerization is very slow.
So dimer is slow because there's a hard barrier, there's a lot of low energy in forming a dimer. Why is dimer slower than anything else? Is it less favorable to form a dimer?
Maybe you have to form the pentamers, which are the basic units. What about those?
Those are already formed.
Dimer of the capsid.
But in the 20 minutes time that he's waiting, he has to form the pentamers,
So they're only there.
They're already there from zero times zero.
Yeah. You never see monomers.
Right. The donuts are always there at time zero. They're there even before we start. So I know I kind of agree, in some sense I agree with you, because I don't know. I mean, this question of whether you have a transient to a dimer, which could be really sharp, because normally you need multiple stages to get a sharp time, right? So that's basically why we started looking at these other kinetic explanations.
What defines time zero in this experiment?
Time zero is we take it out of the storage buffer and we inject it into the assembly buffer, and we start the clock.
What is the physical meaning? How can a dimer be a nucleus? Because somehow it's against any physical intuition I have.
Well, I think, so within the model, basically, so it's not a nucleus. I understand exactly what you're saying, because like if you try to think about the growth in kind of a classical nucleation, you have the radius and it's growing, and so you expect there to be some finite, you know, you have, it's a continuum model, you expect it to go to some place and then go down. And here it's like the first step. So, I mean, the only way that I can really interpret is in the context, if we analyze this discrete model, and if you have a slow step, a slow single step, and then a fast, the other steps are fast, this is what you would expect.
So something has to happen to the protein before it does anything?
There are different postulates. So one is it might be the protein, or maybe after it binds, that helps other proteins to switch somehow. So there are different elaborations. And there's one, so we focused on that, and that's what I'll talk about.
Yeah. If that initial stage is making that unique dimeric structure that Adam was referring to, that then allows subsequent aggregation, that would fit. That you need that unique interaction of the pentamers to make that first dimer before you can get subsequent stages.
Right, so you're saying, so monomer plus monomer goes to dimer. This is slow.
To a specific dimer.
But it says proportional to concentration, basic collision basis. Yes. It's not really anything to do with the proteins inside the fence.
See, there's a fundamental problem is that you're assuming that these are rigid, unchanging blocks. These are incredibly stochastic, wild molecules. And when they associate, you've lost huge degrees of freedom, and you can often undergo really dramatic conformational transitions. So a monomer in solution, part of the problem with the calculations in Viper, for instance, is they're assuming that a monomer in solution is identical to a monomer in the context of a capsid. A monomer in solution is an unknown animal. Monomer in a complex is involved in all sorts of interactions which may constrain it dramatically.
So you're suggesting we should think of having sort of more than just these more species than have been taken into account, for example, that you might have a dimer as initially formed, and then you might have a dimer with some conformational change that occurs slowly?
I thought the situation was...
saying that perhaps you've got two dimer species, only one of which is capable of going further along the pathway, the other is reversible back to monomers.
or they're all reversible, but different flavors of dimers could play with over there.
Well, maybe what is the dimer is catalyzing the reaction itself?
Okay, well, that's what exactly what we're going to talk about right
so
now.
So in that case, you
yeah, so let me... I'll show you exactly what happened. So that was our hypothesis. I'll show you. Okay. Thanks very much. So we were basically looking exactly for that. We were thinking that if you have to get something... So here it is. It's very flat, and then it rises. You know, what can give you this? And the lag is very reproducible. So it's not a Poisson distributed process, that's for sure. So let me just show you, for example, just another blow up here of how flat this is. So basically you get, this is, we have this for several concentrations, it'll look like this. And then if you blow up in this region, so here's 1 million, so the capsid is expected to be at 55, so that's pretty flat here. So the dimer is actually, would be like right around here. So we see that basically all the way through up to the lag time, we don't see significant appearance of dimer.
Can I take these fluctuations seriously?
Okay. Let me explain what those are.
Kind of abortive.
If you see these, all the noise tends to be positive noise, and basically what we expect that is that's very typical in light scattering. If some little dust floats by or something, right. You get that one. So if you look at this curve, it's basically you get this baseline plus these peak.
I had another question about the preceding blow up.
This one?
Yeah.
Or the, yeah.
I mean, if I look at the part until it takes off,
yeah,
and if I average over the noise, doesn't it have a positive slope, a small positive slope there? Or am I seeing
it? It could.
Ruler, it looks like it's sort of linearly increasing to me.
It probably is increasing a little bit. You mean this, like?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, so that's probably, you know, there's probably a slight increase in there. I mean, I don't think... I would be surprised if it were exactly flat.
Like a good way to get yourself crucified in a meeting if you claim that there's a slope.
Yeah, I mean, we're at the limit really of our precision here. So, but
also, it looked like it from the data. I mean, if you average it over bins of 2 minutes or something, I think that you would see a line that was increasing and it didn't have any noise on it. If this happened reproducibly from one run to another run, then I think that you could assure whether or not you would get crucified, I can't say.
Well, I agree with you that there's probably some slight drift, but I probably wouldn't venture to go any farther. But what I would say is that the drift doesn't really take you to like predominantly dimers by the time you start the lag. Sorry? I'll show you that. Yeah, I'll show you that. Okay. So the kind of the model we had was exactly what David brought up here, a model of autocatalysis. And I'll just mention that this idea came to us because if you look at clock reactions, actually many of them have an autocatalytic step, and that's a way you can kind of set the time. So basically when something starts to appear in significant quantity it's autocatalytic, then you can have kind of this exponential, very sharp growth. So our here's this kind of hypothesis, that what happens is that dimer itself can catalyze the formation of more dimer. And I kind of like this idea because not only does it explain a fixed time in kinetics, but it's kind of a nice picture just sterically. I mean, just as if you think about enzyme...
Like ions, right?
Yeah.
You infect autoproteins.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so basically, and also just even from like the kind of enzyme... classical view of enzymes is having binding sites which bind the things that are supposed to add together in the right positions. And that's what these pentamers were meant to do originally in their final state. So, you know, I mean, in two dimensions, it doesn't really quite work. But in three dimensions, you could have this one binding here and this one binding there. And the fact that they're bound already orients them in the correct orientation for them to be a dimer.
But wouldn't that be not second
order? Okay. So, all right. So let me just mention, this is the next thing. I'm going to, sorry.
Before you go ahead, can we go back one?
Yeah.
Okay, now perhaps even two. Adam explained to me that the light scattering data is sort of weight size average.
Yes.
Or size squares average.
It's an average where the weight is proportional to the weight.
Does that mean that sort of larger capsids or larger subassemblies will contribute in much greater proportion to the overall average than the smaller ones?
That's right.
So is it clear that this graph takes off when diners fall, or it may take off when you're perhaps half finished?
Well, what I'm saying is that actually puts us in a more stringent condition then, because if we had, say, capsids, they would be any very small percentage, 1/72nd, you would actually start to see an increase here. So that fact, the amplification of larger species actually puts a more stringent constraint on what's in the solution at this time. Yeah.
But certainly, if you have to wait until, say, tetramers or pentamers have formed, then probably the whole problem would disappear, because it takes time to form these objects.
Right, but the thing is, if it is a question of forming pentamers, they've got to be around in pretty low concentration. You couldn't have 20% pentamers, for instance, at this time.
You have to have 10 billion. You have to have 10 billion nuclei to get this thing to go. So this really is pretty remarkable. There is really nothing going on until about 15 minutes.
Yeah. 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 That's kind of like one of the odd things here. So yeah. Okay. It is weird, right?
David, is that lifetime reproducible?
It is reproducible. It's
lag time.
Yeah, and that's what. So at first we were thinking, nucleation, you get the lag time. Because when you do crystal nucleation, liquid, you get flat and then it takes off. But that's because it's a single event. It's stochastically distributed. It's not. This is not stochastically distributed. In fact, if you estimate the scattering volume, we figure there's probably about 10 billion particles in there.
But is concentration dependent?
It is, and I'll show that. It's concentration dependent. Okay. So, all right. So this is, as Michael pointed out, this is actually trimolecular. But the thing is, just like if regular enzyme catalysis, you could perhaps break this down into other steps. So we kind of see this as one, just that particular example is one model of several in autocatalysis. So this is one I showed you where this would actually be trimolecular, say, where it binds these two, or this is that's the enzyme, these guys form, it's in the right configuration to be another dimer, and then it can come off. But, there's nothing preventing this from happening on larger pieces, actually, at any time. So the thing is, so the typical way you might break this down in an enzyme problem is you say that maybe it binds one and binds a second, and then it splinters off. So this fragmentation, if you just have fragmentation of dimers at any stage of the assembly, this would also contribute to this autocatalysis.
You're telling me that you infect the dimer for a configurational change, and then they break apart again, and it stays in the new configuration?
Okay, so in this model, I'm not invoking this type of internal... I'm not invoking this internal degree of freedom here. Okay. What I'm just saying is that if the presence of dimer speeds up the formation of monomer plus monomer goes to another dimer, then that's autocatalytic.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand why would you want them to fly apart after that? There must be an energetic reason why there must be some affinity for the old proteins for the new configuration.
Right.
For them to break apart doesn't seem to be logical.
Right. I agree. In that this has better energy than this guy, but I think it might be a question of relative rates.
I can see
rates.
The reason you do it is it spreads the disease more quickly, right?
Right. But I think one possible answer to that is that it might be a combinatorial thing. I mean, perhaps this particular thing doesn't happen as often, but the fact that now when you see there's a whole family of these splitting, I mean, if you have pieces coming off, and if any piece can catalyze the formation of monomers becoming part of some capsid and they fall off, and this can be basically autocatalyzed with a high degeneracy.
But this is not consistent with your C-squared dependence of the growth.
Right.
Earlier that the
C-squared dependence of the growth.
The growth was two-point reaction, and this...
I'll show you. Right. So I'll show you. It depends on it depends on the relative rates and the concentrations as time goes on. So basically what we did is to kind of look at the effect of this. We did, just as an example of this class of autocatalysis, we added an extra step. So here we have sequential addition, and all we've done here is we've had this autocatalytic step where dimer catalyzes two monomers to form another dimer. Okay, and when you do that, basically, for the values that we saw, basically we do see now a lag phase which you can control here. So this part really is flat. It's not, the problem in terms of comparing with the experiment is that the takeoff is not quite as linear.
What if you simply assume that the dimer catalyzes not its own formation, but the formation of higher structures? In that case, you would, in order to generate 3, 4, 5,
uh-huh.
you would need dimers to be generated, and the dimer would take enough time just to be around.
So isn't, I'm not sure how that differs from what this step here.
It would not necessarily be autocatalytic. You may have you would jump the second stage,
uh-huh.
but this one, C2 plus C1 to go to C3, would yeah. need C2.
Right. So that's in here already, though.
But it would need C2 as a catalytic step.
Oh, like C2 here?
According to your scenario, wouldn't the dimer concentration...
C2, C2 plus C1 would give C3 plus C2. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So that the growth rate
right.
of the subset would be
yeah.
catalyzed.
I think that's possible.
In this case, the objection yeah. of Michael would not be sustained because it could be still a quality.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, I think the thing is we're not, in the end, as we'll show, because when we compare this model to the, when we look at the concentration depends on lag time, it doesn't really exactly fit. And we only because there's a whole family of different things like this, we only look at one. I think what you're saying still kind of fits into this general idea that if you can have multiple pieces coming off and catalyzing further reactions, basically, that could speed up, that could set a kind of this type of lag time. Okay. So let me just show you here. So just kind of roughly, this is not meant to imply. We just took that simple trimolecular case and just tried to put in some parameters and see what you get. So this is the data I showed you earlier. To kind of get a fit that looks like this, these are all in units of moles and seconds here for this 200 micrograms per mil. The forward rate is actually a little bit slow, but within the range of kind of known association rates, 10 to the 4 per mole per second. This autocatalytic rate has an extra factor of moles in it, so this is 200 micrograms per mil. This actually brings us down into kind of, at this concentration, roughly a competitive rate. And so what happens is basically this part, this initial part is going to be dominated by the formation of these nuclei of dimers, which act as catalysts for further assembly. And what happens is because then the other things grow, it switches over. So that the dominant growth here then becomes the other steps in the mechanism.
But if you change concentration, you have to change parameters, otherwise you won't fit. You won't be able to use the same set of parameters to fit different set of concentrations.
Right, right. Yeah.
What does the final distribution of the sizes look like?
Here?
Yeah.
Well, this step, it doesn't, well, in terms of final, it doesn't affect anything because we haven't changed any of the thermodynamics. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, so the intermediate species are not there? Or are they there?
Well, so this just changes the time course. I mean, so in this model, I haven't changed any of the free energies. So they're just, it's just the same.
Are there, but at very low concentrations.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have your red curve has a very, very fast autocatalytic rate, a very slow K1 is for forming dimers, the initial dimers.
Yeah.
Ka is the autocatalytic rate.
Right.
K4 is the subsequent growth rate.
Right.
And the equilibrium constant, is that per pentamer or pairwise?
That is I'm just trying to remember. I believe that's pairwise. Yeah.
Do you have that graph on the same expanded scale as the previous one, 7 data you showed?
The beginning is not as flat. So it doesn't have ideally, if it were a good fit, you'd have something which is flat and then suddenly looks like this. Now, I don't know if that is due to the fact that you have multiple. I mean, here we just put in this one autocatalytic step. But we don't know if you put in multiple, just like if you look at Smoluchowski kinetics, that when you start having multiple aggregations, then you get this very clean linear behavior in the average molecular weight. It still needs to be timed, right? So I don't know if that would resolve the problem or not, but we didn't really kind of explore the full range of different kinetics.
So this is
kinetic.
A light scattering assay.
Yeah.
It's going back to that whole business of it is dominated by a minority of the population.
Right, right.
And so I'm just trying to get clear if the data are actually picking out part of what the model has in it and it's sharpening it up that way. I'm not clear what
what you're seeing versus what you're modeling is the same thing.
The same thing?
Yeah, is it the same thing? What you call...
Oh yeah. So what I'm plotting is, I run the model and then I calculate the weight average molecular weight.
So it wouldn't be that a minority fraction of there's some disproportionality in how you're seeing it. Or something.
No. So I'm comparing beans to beans here. Yeah.
Then did you get to the place where you were going to show the lifetime as a function?
Yeah. So okay, that's next. Yeah. Okay. So here it is, concentration dependence. So we see. With increasing concentration, the lifetime decreases. This is a concentration
of stuff,
yeah, which is effectively the initial protein concentration.
So it seems to initially drop quickly and then it saturates at 15 minutes. Is that?
Yeah. So I mean, we kind of made this comment in our paper that this part seems to be pretty flat. I mean, I don't know.
What happens if you go to even earlier? Even lower concentrations, does it continue to diverge?
I think we are limited at lower concentration because of signal to noise. Okay. So this is kind of...
Right. It's already micrograms.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
that's pretty impressive that, as you say, it's reproducible. Those lifetimes are reproducible. So
right.
These are real error bars on multiple times.
Okay, so let me clarify here. These are, as I mentioned... because we were sample limited, these are basically single samples here. Okay, so these are our measurement error bars that we estimate based on. So these are not statistical error bars on here. So the error bars on here are not from multiple measurements.
It's like when you fit the curve and you do a plus or minus on your.
Right, that's what this is. But the fact that it's not like this is also an indication that the lag time is reproducible. Right, because if it's like stochastic, then it would be like this with some average like going like this. But even with single measurements, I mean, we see this; it's completely monotonic.
David, in some protein aggregation problem, it looks like that before the aggregation process starts, you have a dynamic distribution of the unfolded protein and an equilibrium distribution of folded ones, or misfolded ones, I should call it, which, if you increase the concentration, then produce the aggregate, so that deviates from classical nucleation growth. And the key point there, let's say for like beta amyloids, is that the critical, that is nucleus, is in thermal equilibrium before process starts. Uh-huh. There are a few of them, but they are in equilibrium.
Right.
Is there any way you can determine these concentrations of the nuclei, the pre-existing nuclei? Do I make sense at all?
Why should the nuclei be in equilibrium before polymerization starts?
So in beta amyloid aggregation, you can have an unfolded protein and a misfolded protein, like in the beta sheet. And the work of Wenzel and others indicates that the way it works at very low concentration, you have a Boltzmann distribution of unfolded and very low concentration of folded ones. Now, nothing happens. If you increase the concentration, then there is a probability for two folded ones to come together, and then it goes downhill because you sort of reduce the parameter energy and they continue to aggregate. That is a complete deviation from classical nucleation and growth, and it's because they're two internal conformation states of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And the key point there is that the initial concentration of these infective nuclei is actually a Boltzmann distribution. There are just very few of them, and it's only when you increase the concentration that you have two or three of them that the process can start.
Sort of makes the definition of what is a nucleus a little...
Wenzel emphasizes that it doesn't obey classical nucleation and growth theory. When you have to have an internal conformation change.
Is the nucleus the rare folded form, or is the nucleus the dimer of that is even rarer?
That's the whole word of the nucleus becomes fuzzy. So it's a beta sheet, so you have a very, they can see them with dichroism. There's a very low concentration of these beta sheet nuclei. And when you put two of them together, then the surface energy is diminished, and then they start to zip together and form very long aggregates.
So the definite, it becomes a semantic problem.
Yes, so there is no well-defined critical nucleus anymore.
Mm-hmm. So your question was whether you could try to look for that experimentally?
So, like, dichroism, is there, do you see...
I mean, that would be kind of the thing to look for.
Have you tried to do, like, vibrational spectroscopy? Could there be two sort of population of proteins?
We thought about doing that, but no, we haven't done that. I think it I mean, the thing is you have to also know kind of what you're looking for.
Well, you would look for proteins which have, you might guess that your pentamers have a somewhat different configuration than they have inside the capsid. There might be configurational change. There might be a physical signature for that.
Yeah.
So if you take a two vibrational spectroscopy of the capsid, that might have a different signature of your pentamers. And then you would say, well, maybe in solution there's a very low fraction of pentamers which does have the signature of the protein as it is in the capsid.
Wouldn't you have to do another control, though? Because, I mean, you don't know how much of it is just due to binding. I mean, even
remember,
if...
Remember, theorists always kind of propose anything.
Yeah, I think it's worth thinking about that some more. Yeah, okay.
Think you can draw a moderately good straight line.
Okay, all right. I'll do that next.
Except for your 15, 20...
Okay, all right. So here's the straight line. So if you fit... So this is a log-log plot now. Oh, did you mean on the log-log plot, or did you mean... Sorry.
If you observe your errors, your measurement errors, you can actually, I think, draw a straight line.
Think about doing something?
Everything except 15.
Something like this? But what would be the meaning of that? What do you have in mind?
That you've got a critical concentration somewhere around 20 micrograms per ml.
Sorry? You're talking about this intercept, or I'm worried about the other intercept. you're thinking about maybe
the lag time is there's something happening at low concentrations, but after that it's just monotonically decreasing in terms of lag time with respect to concentration. It's also just 1 point. It's also
a linear concentration.
That's just 1 point down there, which is
very noisy.
It's conceivable, but at the lowest concentration.
Yeah. So we'd have to think of some mechanism which is linear in concentration, so unimolecular, but then depending on concentration.
What does the logarithmic fit look like?
Okay, so I'll show you the. Okay. So here it is. The logarithmic fit looks kind of like this. It's not great, but if you had to fit a slope to it, it turns out to be about minus 0.43 here. And I'll just point out that the autocatalytic model that we calculated before, you can also figure out what it is, and the slope is closer to -1. If you run, one thing we know is when we ran the different versions of the autocatalytic model, we actually do find different slopes. It's there. The -1 is not a function of the whole family, but of that particular mechanism. We didn't find any particular one that makes it match exactly, and plus we don't know if we have a lot of them running at the same time whether that changes. But
The autocatalytic model has also been Carl Friedman worked on tubulin polymerization and came up with a similar
idea.
But he had whole polymers acting as templates for nuclei. But if you have your autocatalytic model along with a multi-step maturation from, say, called the protonucleus to a nucleus, you would possibly create, well, you provide yourself a more degree of freedom curve fit, but you also create a something that might do a really nice job of fitting the lag followed by
I'm no doubt you would be able to do better. I guess the question is, it comes back to what Robin was saying. I think we'd probably be good to try to think of also experimental things to try to push in that direction.
I didn't actually hear when you said what was defined time zero again. You said something about injection into the nucleus, but...
No, okay.
It changes the
condition. We just changed the buffer condition, that's it, yeah.
And is it stirred all the time?
No, we stirred in the beginning.
Would it matter?
We tried different amounts of stirring in the beginning, and it didn't matter.
I guess one thing that's obvious that would be a way of testing these models is if you change the concentration, added more of the stuff, say, halfway through the
line. Yes, right. So I think the thing is, what would be good to do is to do basically kind of like step experiments. And we actually have done some of those, but as I said, since I guess we're sample limited, we didn't do a lot of those. But I'll show you one at the end here where we did. Okay. So let me just mention this one. I'll show you, to conclude, I just want to show you Oh, we're running quite late. Yeah, so maybe let me just finish. Yeah, I'll just mention. Okay, so here's kind of the last thing I want to say. I'll show you this is coming back to this question of the error correction, the fact that you might have to go off this kind of one-dimensional mechanism. And one other variation of this. Okay, so the autocatalytic, you kind of go off as this other way to get to the same endpoint. So another version of this coming off this one-dimensional mechanism is that if you go down dead ends, if you make a mistake. So I just want to just give you kind of why we think this might, what you might see in the kinetics. So we just have this toy model of a two-dimensional polygonal capsid. And just like in three dimensions, you could have two angles. Here, if we have two angles, say alpha and beta, you need to have the right set of alpha and betas to close. And so we have an energy for closing. And you also want to have something, we put in a check for overlap, and we just did that approximately by saying once we go more than 360 degrees around, we throw those out. Okay, so basically the feature of this model is that you can make mistakes, and after a certain amount of time, you know that you've made a mistake. Okay. And so how does that, how would you...
Is it built out of triangles?
This is built out of lines. I'll show you on the next slide here. So this is built out of lines. So basically, a line plus line can form this or this. So this would be two binding angles, and so on. So one and one goes to two, goes to three, and you can form basically different binding angles. And just like before, you can basically write down a set of equations, but you quickly, because you can make mistakes, there's actually not one path anymore, so there's a lot of structures you can do. So the way we handle this is just by running a stochastic Monte Carlo simulation. Okay? So here this is the result. So basically, if you just stick on one-dimensional path, that's this purple curve, which, and if you have, with the same parameters now, but allow different angles, you basically kind of see this two-stage kinetics. Where basically what happens right in the beginning, you do make a bunch of correct ones. This is the number of correctly formed capsids versus time. And basically, in the beginning, you make a bunch of good ones, but you're also making wrong ones. And what happens is it takes some time for those wrong ones to get fixed. And that's this part basically corresponds to the error correction.
It requires partial disassembly of
the... It requires partial disassembly.
And if your dissociation rates are relatively slow, then you might actually, that'll get dragged up.
Right, so we looked at different models. So it depends on what it takes to fix an error. If you have to break off and reform, then that's going to be controlled by that. We also ran models where you can change the angle, which you might expect might be easier in three dimensions, then that's controlled by that rate.
That's the point where basically all of the initial units have been combined into some kind of capsid.
So this is basically, right, how many are just get it right on the first go?
No, but I'm asking, is that the point where there's none of the original stuff is left at that point? None of the single units are left at that point?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You have a bunch of individual units that are aggregating together.
Yeah.
And the picture I was getting from what you're saying is that in that initial rise, they're all aggregating together, and then you run out of material.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got nothing left but right capsids and wrong capsids.
Right.
And the subsequent part there is the wrong capsids reforming themselves. But there isn't any...
Well, there are different ways. There are different ways to get out of your mistake. So either the wrong ones can fall apart and redo the right ones, or they can fall off and the new guys form stock to form correct ones. And we also, the other model where we run, where it's basically controlled by fixing the angle, you can actually fix an angle, then that's...
But I guess I'm just asking you to agree with her. I'm not asking you a long discussion. Will you agree or disagree that after that initial
that's right.
Part of the initial stuff?
That's correct. Okay, that's correct. That's awesome. But it's not true in the other case, when the angle bending.
For more complex cases, the picture you're drawing is that if you put a pentamer in the wrong place and you keep it wrong, it will never close. Maybe strains will build up.
Right.
And bone
that's exactly what we're saying.
And
you
disassemble it and it just keeps on trying until it puts the pentamer in the right
place. That's exactly what we're saying. Right. Yeah.
What we made from this is that if you have a kinetic trap of one sort or another, it's going to take a long time to resolve.
Right. So errors are a type of kinetic trap. Right. That's the point.
But also the reason to be a problem with the thorium explosion, because if you can't many kinetic traps, then even in equilibrium, you will be leaving most QZ.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And so one of the things I think there are different the different things, there's, and I think the combinatorial thing, so we did kind of just one study here where we varied the angle in this model. And basically, if you have shallower angles, it takes, you can actually make a mistake longer. And so you have more, that has a combinatorial aspect to it, but also has a number aspect. You can go farther before you figure it out that you made a mistake. And basically, you can compare how, you know, we vary two parameters, how the depth of the error and also the reverse rate, the attempt to fix yourself. And the more important factor is how long you can go before, because it's combinatorial, it's multiplicative. The deeper errors take longer to fix. Okay. I'll just one slide. Okay. So the thing is, Polyoma. So this is actually the last experiment here. Basically, we do see this two-stage kinetics in polyoma. As I mentioned earlier, we gave this up because this phase was really long. When we went back to look at the data, we actually see kind of this very rapid rise. Here's an inset blowing it up here, where we see something which is fast, and then this is basically, it tails out after about two days or so. So we do see something. And this is...
So there is no lag time.
So in this case, we don't see a lag time, or it's very right, or it's sub second. Yeah. Now the thing is, this is hours, minutes, seconds. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
It's
actually
sorry.
It's day. It's only.
Yeah, this is right. One day. That's 2 days. Sorry about that. Yeah.
So 20 minutes we will not see here.
20 minutes is like, right, so this is 2 hours. 20 minutes is here. Yeah, 20 minutes is there.
And your experiment does not allow to resolve 20 minutes.
We do. We can blow it up, and what we do is we just see this curve. It's a curve with the noise
so
on top of it.
There is no lag time.
We don't see a lag time. Yeah, that's right. So I didn't emphasize that here, but we don't see a lag time. If you blow it up, you don't see the lag time.
Self-similar curve.
Okay, so that pretty much wraps it up, I think. These are the pictures of that and then conclusions, which I think we don't need to do. All right.